Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're continuing our coverage of the Air Force Association's annual Airspace Cyber Conference and Trade Show, this year being conducted virtually. And it is my honor to welcome General Tim Ray, the commander of the U.S. Air Force's Global Strike Command and Air Force's Strategic Air, the steward of two of the three legs of the nation's nuclear strategic triad with 30,000 airmen, 178 aircraft, and 406 land-based Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles that have been a core part of the nation's nuclear vigilance for five decades. General Ray, thanks very much for joining us, and a very happy 73rd birthday to the United States Air Force.
Hey, thanks, Fargo. I appreciate that. Great welcome.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Sir, COVID, you know, you joked you'd like to punch COVID in the nose. I think you're not the only one. We're doing this interview remotely, and everybody has been impacted around the world. Fortunately, you guys have managed to be able to operate and do so safely. You know, very briefly, talk to us about some of the changes you've instituted at the command. You know, how COVID has sort of permanently changed how you're going to operate over the long term, and to be better prepared for future crises, whether it's another pandemic event or, God forbid, a national security emergency.
Hey, Vago, I tell you that the thing I'm most proud of in this command is how well all the airmen did at every level. We took a very aggressive stance on trying to anticipate our challenges. We were watching this pretty early. We started thinking through how we would handle it. You pay us to do this job under all conditions and not just the ones of our choosing. So, you know, we don't have a pandemic exemption here. So we knew we had to keep it going. And real impressed with how well all the commanders really stayed connected to every level of the organization, really good transparent communication, good thinking. We really figured out discipline, self-isolation. We had a good A-team, B-team construct. We did some really smart things with pushing those who are more susceptible, you know, to home and to work, you know, virtually. We really worked hard to create more of a more conducive environment out in the ICBM fields. We took an opportunity to really crank up the Wi-Fi capacity, since these kids are going to be out there for 2 weeks at a pop and then later 1 week at a pop. You know, wanted to make sure quality of life was good, and found better, smarter ways to feed them. The morale is high. The morale was incredibly high based on, you know, this coming together as a team and really being focused on the priorities. Bomber team, you know, we were able to end the continuous bomber presence, right, let us come home and retool. And, you know, the readiness numbers on the bomber side. And I don't know if you heard the SecDef this morning. You know, talk about our readiness rates, our alert rates for the ICBM force. Our bomber readiness numbers in terms of qualified crews is better in COVID than it was before. And so the team has really rallied. I think we have a really good new normal. We took the posture of playing this pace until next June, you know, when we thought there was going to be a good vaccine and, you know, some other therapeutic, you know, solutions to this. So we took the long view, and we set the posture, and we're in the groove. And so I think this has been a really good news story for the team.
Let's talk a little bit about the threat. You're in the forefront of deterrence, been executing the mission around the world, some very, very impressive displays of strategic air power. Talk to us a little bit about what are the Chinese and the Russian capabilities that concern you the most and factor most prominently in shaping your operational, doctrinal training? And we can talk a little bit more in specifics about your hardware needs as well.
Yeah, Vago, let's take on the Russian question. You know, I think broadly for both of these two players, you know, it's the fact that they want their own sphere of influence and they're not really willing to play by the international norms. And you can see that in living color as we fly our BTFs and, you know, how the Russians react to that. You know, my sense is that we've got a great advantage with a superb alliance, you know, with NATO and our other European partners. I don't think the Russians can muster a team, you know, a tenth as good. So part of what we're there for is really to be there with our partners and allies. We had the one sortie that flew over, you know, 30 of our allied countries in a single day. I mean, it was a, you know, not just for the Russians, but for our teammates over there. So I think keeping the pressure there and having the great teamwork with General Harigi and General Walters and, you know, how we support them, I think that's going to just continue to be a good news story. You know, when I go out to the Pacific, what does give me concern is the full spectrum capacity of the Chinese, the pace that they're keeping and their ability to sustain it, you know, and it's a more fulsome concern. I do remain deeply concerned about where they're going with their nuclear capacity. You know, I don't think that that's going to stay in the same lanes that we've been able to really assume them staying in. So, you know, we're going to have to be much more competitive with a different geographical makeup and a different alliance construct. So it's going to be a more complicated scenario for us to, as a nation, to continue to compete well.
Two of the three legs of all three legs of the triad are being modernized. Two of them are under your watch, the B-21 bomber, obviously, and the ground-based strategic deterrent. You can even add the B-61 weapon, which falls, you know, obviously goes with the B-21 and the rest of the force. You've said you need a bomber force of 220 aircraft and sufficient numbers of hypersonic weapons to be able to make a difference. Given this new strategic environment we're in, and given the new hypersonic age that we're approaching, how many more bombers do you need than that? And what are the kinds of hypersonic capability you need? And how much of that has to be nuclear, given that both of our adversaries are talking about nuclear hypersonic glide vehicles?
Yeah, so I think 220 is that what the analysis tells us. And so here we are in 2020. The roadmap to 175 or 220, it's identical through 175. So I'm focused on getting that to be a credible and executable plan. My sense is that you've got some incredibly good and healthy programs in play. You heard the Secretary of the Air Force, the Chief, talk about it. You've heard the SecDef talk about the digital engineering. I will tell you, we've been very fortunate in this command to have teammates in the acquisition side of the house who are leveraging the digital engineering, the agile software deployment development. I would believe the experts in OSD will tell you that the GBSD program is a pathfinder for all those things. So we've been doing that for a number of years, and it's really bearing fruit. You saw that the milestone B in the transition to the EMD contract was on time for the GBSD. You know, all part of the reality of how well that's come together. We're going to apply that formula of the digital engineering. We're going to apply the formula of owning the technical baseline, being modular in your design with open mission systems capability, being ruthless in the stability of the requirements so that our industry partners and we can get the capability you know, in the silo, on the ramp, or in the air, as fast as we can, with lots of capacity to rapidly modify, rapidly upgrade, and keep things viable and affordable. That is how I'm approaching the bomber roadmap and the whole nuclear recapitalization. And I'm pleased to report, you know, the helicopters playing down that path, the cruise missiles playing down that path, the B-21s playing down that path, the GBSD is playing down that path. And we've been very consistent on time with every RFP, with every CDD. You know, the command has really enjoyed great teamwork with the acquisition side of the house, OSD, and certainly with the Hill. So I think, you know, that formula has to be your entering argument. Then we can set the stage for, you know, my replacement or whoever's behind me to actually start realizing those options. And the real options come some number of years from now. I think we're on a great path to be able to execute that. And then your decisions are, you know, later in this decade that can really be tailored to the world around us. I believe hypersonics are a big part of that. You know, and I think the conventional version is where we need to go first. So I want to solve that problem first and make sure we can do what we need to do before I begin to expand that conversation.
And that extends to nuclear as well, in terms of a hypersonic nuclear capability, because there's a tendency of people not thinking that those two can be conjoined, even if that's where our adversaries might be going.
To be fair, an ICBM is just a ballistic hypersonic weapon. Right. So, you know, it's not a question of, you know, that per se. I mean, you may sound like I'm splitting hairs here, but, right. You know, it's we really aren't in a place, I think, now where we have to make that change, right. Because I believe we've got some great capabilities, you know, online. But, you know, to go down the hypersonic weapon, we're not in that conversation right now.
Let me ask you about long range unmanned, right? Historically, your force has been a manned force. It's driven in part by the nuclear mission, which is why B-21, while there was a lot of conversation about optional manning, was concluded that you know, you wanted humans to be in the loop. What role do you see for large, right? The Navy is getting over its bugaboos and proposing some very, very large surface ships to be effectively floating magazines for the battle force. How do you envision large unmanned strategic aircraft in any future mix?
Ivago, I've not tried to solve that problem yet. You know, I wanted to spend the majority of my time in the seat to go set the foundation so that, you know, when Congress looked at our bomber roadmap, they would see a credible plan. And I think that's where that plays now, that when we started talking about how we operated as an air component and supported strategic command so that I could begin to really relevantly operationally shape how we do things, how NC2 over assured comms matches with JADC2. And there's tremendous overlap there. So, you know, where we've been is how to get the nuclear piece right as a strategic resource. And so to come back to your question, we'll always need a man in the loop, you know, a person in the loop on the execution line of the nuclear weapons. And so, we're solving that problem first, and to make sure that everything we're doing in support of this, as I go back to my previous comment, that it's affordable, sustainable. Vago, we can't out just spend our way through this. You know, the analogy I share is you can't be a pole vaulter here. You got to be a hurdler, and then you got to make sure that those hurdles are as low as possible to have this sustained competition. You know, and I think that's the piece I've tried to drive into the foundation. And I think that makes a lot of options in the future possible.
Let me ask you about surging. And I truly see the logic of that, right? I mean, if you make everything a really high stretch goal, you're then going to be chasing your tail and pouring a lot of resources into something that we may not have. You have an aging bomber force, but still a very capable one. and have certainly managed to deliver some very, very powerful lessons around the world. In a 24-hour period, you managed to demonstrate strategic air power across the NATO alliance, obviously got Russia's attention with some of this, and certainly being present all over in the Pacific. There was some concern folks had that the forward-based bombers were being pulled out, but certainly now people are beginning to see the logic of this agile force employment model. And bombers historically have tended to bed down in a place, not operate the way that you're operating them globally. What are some of the lessons you're learning to refine some of your future operational concepts to sort of yield that even more agile force you want for the future?
Yeah, we've worked a lot with the PACAF teammates and the USAFE teammates. They've led a lot of the thinking on how to do the stand-in force, and you've got to have a stand-in force. Let me be pretty clear. You've got to have someone to stand toe-to-toe with your adversaries alongside your partners and allies, which means you're forward. And so you need the right blend of standoff and stand-in. And so that learning that they've done, we've benefited from. We've had a good conversation begun between the air components around the planet to make sure that we get even better at these bomber task forces, how quickly we can bed down, how quickly we can move, how quickly we can integrate and make that just really second nature. That's the work we're trying to do now. And I think, you consider what we really require to go do what we need to do. We've taken a good hard look at what resources have to come forward with us. We can tailor a bomber task force from one all the way up to six. And if I really need to add more, I could go, to 8, 12, but they're building blocks now and they're more discernible and just depends on what we want to do. So I think your ability to be on the ground with a lighter footprint, to be able to bring combat capability from multiple directions, I think that becomes incredibly powerful.
Let me ask you about the integration of that power. Obviously, the entire joint force is working this problem, an incredible demonstration. Dr. Roper talked about the September 3, 2020 exercise where Army howitzers were able to intercept cruise missiles to try to do air-based defense. I know he's very excited about that, but that was a demonstration of both ABMS as well as the JAD C2 concept. Each one of the military services is working their own element of the national deep strike enterprise. The Army is working in its long range fires. The Navy is working this problem. As the person who brings and is so core to that ability to strike at mass and range, what does this integrated national strike enterprise need to look like from your standpoint as a strategically thinking airman?
Bhagwa, I think the entering argument for long-range precision fires is JADC2, and ABMS is the centerpiece of that. If you can't find, fix, target, track fast enough, then it doesn't matter. And so I think, what the Air Force has taken the lead on to drive this is exactly where we need to go. Preeminent in that conversation is space. Could not ask for a better path forward. I'm just so impressed with General Raymond and his approach to be fast and lean. To me, that's one of the biggest military problems to solve. I think we're on track there. And as we begin to really take hold of all the different elements of, Cloud One, et cetera, then it becomes more real. To an airman, this is instinctively obvious. I'm not trying to be arrogant about that. That's how we've seen the world for many, many years. But if you're going to do precision long range strike, you've got to have space and you got to have JADC2. We're exactly on track. The NC2 over assured comms piece, the connectivity is, the tech that's involved there is the same tech we need. Our adversaries are not going to play by the old Cold War rules about, keeping things, discreet and untouched. That's just not realistic anymore. And there's more players on the field. So, you know, if you took ABMS and JADC2 and laid them side by side with where we need to go with NC2 over assured comms for the future, there's only one difference, and that's the fact that I have to have a man, a person in the loop for execution. That's the only difference. So we see ourselves from every end of the spectrum of conflict in that particular part, be it presence to conventional strike all the way up to nuclear.
Are you happy where you are in terms of coordinating and cooperating with your sister services to be able to deliver a more sensible overall plan? Because there are some folks who ask, well, you know, kind of the Marines are doing their thing and the Army's doing their thing and the Navy's doing their thing, and whether, you know, there's enough connective tissue among all of you to make sure that we don't end up with something either piecemeal or potentially redundant.
The chief has been good about, you know, accelerate, change, or lose. He's talking about roles and missions conversations. I think he's got that exactly right. You know, I've been really fortunate to have worked with General Brown, you know, over the years as a general officer. And, you know, we've got a great chief, and I think he sees it for what it is. There really isn't the luxury of having things that aren't going to be as good as we need them to be. I think we've proven with the bombers that we can bring all kinds of long-range precision fires very quickly without the axis basing and overflight with very responsive times. I think that's a very germane dimension of how we engage in the Pacific. I think it's a broader set of options in Europe because of just the geography. So it's how we think that part through and how we really compete with those two adversaries.
One follow-up. So do you feel you've got the right intellectual framework for how to do that competition, especially vis-a-vis the Chinese? Are you comfortable with where you are?
Vago, I think we're comfortable that we understand the situation. Let me just kind of offer an insight, I think, that's helpful. You know, Simon Sinek talks about Cold War 2.0, you know, and he would tell you Cold War 1.0 had an economic tension, an ideological tension, and a nuclear tension. I think the shift that we've got to start the conversation with a China competitor is in a Cold War 2.0 of, yes, there's an absolutely an ideological tension. There's absolutely an economic tension. And that's where most have not closed the gap, is that there's absolutely a nuclear tension. And that becomes a very different way of thinking of how you really deal with a nuclear armed adversary. We've never gone to war with one. And we've started every conflict since North Korea, Korea on our own terms. The game has changed. And so how we play that game has to be how we as the United States with partners and allies and Department of Defense, Department of the Air Force, solve those problems. And I think where we are as Global Strike Command, I think we've really well postured to help do that. And I think that will become much more apparent as time goes and we see the real stripes of China.
There's a considerable debate, sir, you know, whether to retain all three legs of the nuclear triad. Right now, the policy of the nation remains that, but there are folks who continue to debate. We don't need LRSO, certainly in a nuclear capacity. There's B-61 questions, and then some people say, well, the ground-based triad needs to be canceled. What's the strategic rationale for a balanced triad in this era of great power competition?
Vago, I think that's an excellent question. You know, when I consider this problem, and it is a problem, you know, I have to start, and I alluded to it earlier, you got to have the right context. Here's the analogy that I offer. If you're in a big city and you're standing there at an intersection and there's a nice clear crosswalk painted and there's the sign where the little light shows that you have, you know, permission to walk. Philosophically, you have every right to be in that crosswalk. Philosophically, by law and rule, you've got every right to be there. But if you don't properly consider the entire context, philosophically, you were right, But when the truck runs you over, you're absolutely dead. And so what we can't do is argue for our own context. The context is unequivocal. There is a Chinese triad. There is a Russian triad. And there is the guarantee to our partners and allies about extended deterrence, right? And so this is really a much broader conversation, and we can't take a philosophical bent. We've got to stick with this context and compete in it. Brightest military mind of our generation, General Secretary Mattis, he says, I've thought about this and I cannot solve the deterrent question, reducing it from a triad. Some out there will go through and they'll cite USSECDEF, but you know, of 10, that would be one dissenting opinion compared to the other 9. And so it becomes, I think, really, you've got to really understand the context of this. And when you do, you realize you don't have the luxury. I used to believe that we were going to have really a great opportunity under, you know, where we're going with the Russians. We've done well as a country where arms control and modernization go well together. And while you look at, you know, what we have with the Russians, you now have a very interesting dynamic that you have a third player on the field. And if that player, I'm not saying they are, but if that player can reach parity with you and at least one leg of the triad, how does that change your thinking? And that becomes where we've got to be willing to step back and really consider the entire playing field.
Let me ask you about Russia's doctrine. They call for first use of a tactical nuclear weapon as part of a strategy that they define as escalate to de-escalate. It's essentially a brushback pitch with a weapon small enough that may not elicit a strategic nuclear response. There are those who say all nuclear weapons are strategic, and so, you know, sort of the big bombs, although we have the detuned W-76 out there to give us a little bit more flexibility. The concern is we're against an adversary that actually has a much larger tactical arsenal. At the end of the day, what's the right approach to deterring adversaries that may have a larger number of tactical nuclear weapons and have a fundamental approach that may be anathema? You know what I mean? It may be anathema to our thinking per your last point, but it's actually core to their thinking. Are we doing enough and are we thinking through this problem enough to be able to sufficiently deter whether it's Russia or China?
I think what keeps Russia up at night is NATO. And, you know, you have to look at that in that context. Look, any policy on this, you know, that resides with an authoritarian, you know, realist regime, that policy can change overnight. So, I mean, it's good to know, it's good to think about, but, you know, look at China. Hong Kong was a, you know, one country, two system policy until it decided the policy was going to change. So it's good to have that in the playing field, but I don't overvalue that. I look at where their red lines are and where their threats really begin to pressurize them. I think it's a little more discernible. I think regime survival becomes one of the things you've got to really understand and how that plays. And I think it's a little more nuanced in some cases, but you know, what greater, better way to keep NATO honest than to say, you know, you'll play that way when in fact it really isn't only in the direst, most extreme circumstances. So I think it's a little more different than people give it credit for. I do believe we've got to find a way to account for and to validate and to control the numbers of nuclear weapons on the planet. That's just good for everybody. So we've got to have the conversations about how we get those heading in the right direction. But that's descriptive. I will resist any attempt to be prescriptive on exactly what that means.
Is it safe to say then that the strategic arsenal is sufficient to deter? So if somebody thinks they're going to be cute by detonating a small weapon somewhere off to the side as part of a broader, that actually rings the big nuclear alert light, and then actually the strategic arsenal is sufficient deterrence in that case. Would that be safe to say?
The way I come at the whole conversation, Bago, is how you retain the resources to manage, control, and compete in the escalatory. You know, I think there's a lot of folks who start from tactical to operational to strategic. I go back to my earlier point. You've got to go strategic to operational to tactical. Right. You have these two players on the field. And if you have a good mind for that, then I think you've got a good picture of what may happen.
Let me ask you one last question about nuclear mindedness. You know, we went from an era where it was counterterrorism was the focus. Now we're going back into a great power competition. We're looking at bolstering capabilities of our arsenal. Are you satisfied, and are we doing enough to create nuclear minded thinkers of a brand and depth and variety that existed when you started your career in the B-52 force in 1985? I mean, obviously that was at the height of the Cold War, so maybe it's not a direct analogy, but are we doing enough to create a senior leadership cadre and even train civilian leaders to wrap their mind the right way around the kind of nuclear and strategic threats facing the nation?
The short answer is yes. You know, and I would step back, I think the national security strategy, the National Defense Strategy, the Nuclear Posture Review, all these guidance documents, well aligned, that, you know, I think they're absolutely pertinent, you know, and as we continue to shift, then, you know, those things become, you know, more of a foundation for what we're doing. And it helps people, I think, as long as we stay focused on, you know, where the priorities are, to get smarter and better. And I really resist the going back to the Cold War, because there's some things that were there, but the playing field is so much more dangerous, so much more diverse than it was. So it takes a more generalized competitive mindset with all the right things considered for us to be really successful.
Last question. You've been very generous with your time. You flew the B-52G, one of the coolest airplanes ever. You know, 8 J-57s with water injection. Tell us what a takeoff in a B-52G was like for you, because it is the most unreal sound I've ever experienced, short of a lot of tweets on a runway somewhere.
Vago, I tell you, when they first told me they were going to do that, you know, I'm a skeptic. In a lot of ways, I said, this is a joke. This can't be real, that we're actually going to take all this water and dump it into an engine, which is a controlled fire. And, you know, so there was a logic challenge for me early on. And then when I did it, I thought it was probably one of the most unnerving and natural things to do in an airplane. So probably, as you know, it was really a challenge to watch that everything was going to work like it was supposed to, but I'll never forget the first time it stopped working when it was supposed to, and how big of an adjustment that was. I honestly thought we're going to fall out of the sky, because, you know, you just have such a sudden decrease in thrust. But I am very grateful that I flew the bulk of my career in the H model. I guarantee you, flying low level, I'm alive today because I did. You know, that I think is just an icon of the old SAC era. Glad it happened, but I'm glad I don't have to do that again.
Sir, thanks very much, General Ray. It's always an honor and pleasure, and look forward to talking to you again in the future. And again, a very happy birthday to the United States Air Force. Thanks again.
Thanks again. Great conversation.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.